May 2019, as part of the flurry of articles around the ending of Game of Thrones, the online news source Vulture published the 12 best Game of Thrones battles, ranked. At the bottom of the list, in number 12, was the Battle of Whispering Wood from season 1, featuring Robb Stark's great victory over the Lannisters and the capture of Jaime Lannister. At number 1, a pretty controversial choice, the Fall of King's Landing from season 8, episode The Bells. Part 1 of our last podcast focuses on the topic of warfare in Game of Thrones, something that is at the center point of the series across its 8 seasons. To think about how Game of Thrones represent medievalist warfare, I speak to Peter Konechny. Peter founded medievalist.net in 2008, the leading website in the niche of medieval studies. He is also the editor of Medieval Warfare magazine, which is based out of the Netherlands.
Thank you so much, Peter, for agreeing to speak with me today on this topic of warfare in Game of Thrones. I have to say, out of all the topics that we're covering for the course, this is the one that I feel like I have the least amount of knowledge about. So I really appreciate you sharing your insight.
Oh, but this is the most funnest part of the topic.
I think a lot of my students would agree with you. I have a few of them that are doing their projects on medieval military history and Game of Thrones. That's great. I'm sure you're glad to always create new medieval military historians. So let me start with a question thinking about the battles, because Game of Thrones, of course, cinematically is known for its battles and the enormous amount of money that the show has spent on producing these battles. So throughout the series, we have all these battles with different armies and navies. We have naval battles like Blackwater Bay in season 2, or Euron's attack on Yara's fleet in season 7, which I just watched again. And we have huge armies fighting in the Battle of the Bastards in season 6, or The Long Night in season 8. And The Long Night is actually our focus episode for the class on warfare. And then we have these sneak attacks from the Dothrakian dragons, where Daenerys hits the loot train after Jaime Lannister and company have conquered Highgarden. How reflective are such cinematic battles of medieval warfare? Do we have knowledge of similar types of battles in the medieval period?
In terms of the, say, cinematic, it's not very reflective, in part because the demands of the show mean that every battle has to be unique. You can't have everything happen the same way. Like, they fight and the victory and loss happens the way. So in that way, when they make a show, they say, all right, how are we going to make this battle different and unique? And that will always take away from any kind of historical comparisons, right? The second is that they also have to focus on main characters. They have to be doing something, right? So as a medieval military historian, sometimes, oh, they wouldn't have done this, or the commanders shouldn't be fighting like this. The biggest trope in movies is that you have a medieval battle and it descends into 1,000 people fighting one-on-one against another person, right?
Yeah.
Like somehow the commanders will wind up fighting each other at some point that they get to. If I said what would be the most historically based battle, it's the first battle of Winterfell. That's where Ramsay Bolton defeats Stannis. And so his army marches there, and Bolton just, they come out and they charge at it and they wipe him out. And funny thing, there's not much to see in that battle. They don't really depict it very much, right? Because it is, in one way, just a boring battle of a charge. And one side gets defeated really quickly, because a lot of battles, medieval battles, end really quickly. The very odd ones that can last an entire day, like the Battle of Hastings in 1066, it lasts hours and hours. But most battles that we see, they tend to last maybe an hour at most.
So they're very short in comparison to what we see. For example, The Long Night takes the whole episode, right?
That's right. So in events, it can be soon determined on who wins or who loses. In a sense, so if you take a shot and you lose, say you send out a charge, there's not much to defend. Either you've lost and you can figure out you have to retreat or get away, or the other side will now be able to attack you, right? In the kind of battles like in Game of Thrones, there's a give and take. One side's winning, one side's losing, maybe. A different kind of strategies happen. They allow them to make maneuvers that just wouldn't happen.
To make it much more, clearly more dramatic. Obviously, a short battle that seems more like what we had known historically wouldn't make for such great TV.
The one thing for medieval historian is that there's a lot more professionalization. People know how to fight in medieval armies, and they know how to take advantage of what they can do. Say, like, Battle of Blackwater Bay. Towards the end, some of the ships of Stannis reach and land, and they're at the city walls. But what you have is the other guys come out of the wall to attack. They wouldn't do that. they do it for that. But like in reality, they would just stand behind their walls. They would stand on top of the walls and just pick off the people. They would make use of that advantage. And then the show, they can't do that, right? So
like wow. Monty Python, where they hurl insults at them from the walls yeah. of the castle in the same way.
And of course, in medieval times, they would hurl insults all the yes. time and stuff like that. So
yeah, Monty Python's another discussion. I actually teach a course on Monty Python, and we talk about various ways that Monty Python is historically authentic to the medieval period in ways that something like Game of Thrones actually isn't. So warfare is really at the center of this show. It's all about the conflict for succession to the Iron Throne. In my last podcast where I spoke with Miriam Shattis about queenship, one of the things that we explored was that it's really about succession between a group of women to gain the throne. But was war really at the center of people's lives in the medieval period? Because in the entire series of Game of Thrones, except for the very beginning, mm-hmm. war is a key part of what's going on in the background of the whole thing, all 8 seasons.
It's a yes and no. In the yes way, medieval society is often dominated by people in the warrior class, soldier mm-hmm. class. If you're a king, you get to that position, you hold that position because you're able to succeed militarily, right? There's always people that are reasons for fighting or not to fight. We do have, you know, lots if any typical medieval reign, if you've lasted for 20 years, you've been involved in some sort of warfare action. But it can also change from place to place. If you look at, say, the city of London, if you mm-hmm. lived in London, there would be a stretch between, say, 1265 and the Peasants' Revolt in 1389, where there wasn't any, I can't think of any military action that takes place in or around London. You have armies moving in and out, and you have command. But if you were a person living their streets, you would not have had a fear for your life for a good, like, 120 years. There just wasn't an attack. And then you have a peasants' revolt. That happens. But then you don't have any kind of other attack for well into the 15th century. So, like, in a sense, like, people could live their lives not knowing warfare, not having that personal experience. But there was always military because those who are in charge are usually military figures. Mm-hmm. So there's always that element. So you're always paying taxation, which usually goes to military, and that can go up and down. The rhetoric often revolved around fighting, so say the Crusades. So that was hard-boiled into medieval society, that being a warrior and being involved in the military was part of what you did. And that fighting, usually the higher classes, so lower classes, not necessarily as a peasant, you might be drafted into a warfare or become a mercenary or have to do things that are related to military, but it is a time and place.
It sounds like it depends upon your socioeconomic status. So if you're mm-hmm. part of the elite, more noble class, warfare is much more a part of not only how you define yourself, but yeah. how you think about the role that you play in society. And so it's always around. But if you're part of a lower class, depending yeah. upon where you live and what's going on, then that's not necessarily going to impact your life yeah. all the time.
Yeah, I think if you are one of the majority, warfare is something that you mostly hear about and may actually come to your doorstep once in your lifetime. But if you get more involved in it, then you do it all the time.
It's interesting because that's not the perception that the broader public has, right? The broader public, when they think about the medieval period, they perceive it as a time of where there's lots of warfare going on, where most people are involved in warfare. So why do you think they have that perception? When I teach medieval history, I'm not a military historian. I'm a social historian. So my tendency is to focus on the social history aspects of it. But my students come to my class mm-hmm. wanting me to talk about warfare all the time. So why is there that perception, do you think?
I think it's just the more exciting part of history is warfare and violence. People like talking about it. People like talking about it in the Middle Ages. If you read Icelandic sagas, for instance, those are the best ways of windows into daily life. But all the Icelandic sagas are talking about some sort of feud or conflict, because that's what's interesting. No one writes about, oh, I did this, I was on my farm today, we farmed these sheep and they were there. You don't get that, like, because that's just a normal humdrum day. And even medieval people would write for the excitement of events where there's conflict and a chance for violence. So chroniclers talk a lot about warfare because it's interesting, it's new. And so that's what, you know, society's kind of been fed on that, right? So when I started as a student, I remember the first like university they gave first class that I did medieval studies at university. First thing it goes was this charter from the town of Bruges in 1127. And oh, here's this charter and da, 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 here's what they did. And we didn't get much context out of it, but I went and did a little bit more. And it happens during this midst of this civil war that's happening in Flanders. So it's the great story of the murder of Charles the Good. And sometimes historians, we try and ignore that, but and I love doing social history too, but the military can pervade all sorts of that life. It pervaded in Middle Ages, and that's what people wanted to talk about. And then, so I'm not surprised that people want to talk about it today too. And that's what captures their interest, because that's what's different.
Yes. And I think that would be a hard sell to have a TV series around medieval peasant life involving farming the fields. I don't know how many people were. One of the things we've talked a lot about in this class is how little we see of lower status people in Game of Thrones, particularly peasants who seem to just serve as people to be killed. But we don't really get anything about their daily lives. And I think it's not considered cinematic to watch that.
We don't get any agency from medieval peasants. There's this one story where there's this group of peasants that have a kind of a religious commune, and they wind up getting wiped out, right? But that would be a much larger movement. There would be all sorts, and they would have had protection. They would understand they're not rubes, right?
Like, yes.
They would have known what to do. I'm sure they may have been caught by a conflict and stuff like that, but no one was that pacifist.
My students and I have had a lot of discussion about that. So this kind of leads into my next question, which is George R. R. Martin and the producers of the show, Benioff and Weiss, have argued that Game of Thrones represents a more realistic, grim, dark version of the medieval period than the Disneyfied version presented in other novels or television shows. And they've used this to defend, for example, their representation of sexual violence as this is what the Middle Ages was like. It's this time of violence. So what role does warfare play in supporting that perception of the Middle Ages as this violent, grim, dark period?
So they'll do things like show at the end of the battle, the people getting executed on the battlefield.
Yeah.
And it's so easygoing. And it says where there's, you just have a guy come along and stab people, just walking along gingerly. And so you don't get a scene where people get buried, right? Or people doing prayers in or after the battle. You don't see the other aspects that you would say that would make it less dark. I always think that Game of Thrones is just way too dark as a depiction of medieval life. And I understand Martin was like saying, Tolkien and that kind of ilk is too fancy a world of their medieval world. It's too nice, right? Let's make it more realistic. But I think he's gone like too far the other way, because you don't have anything resembling people doing things out of pious motivation or feeling truly. So medieval people, just like modern people, really believed when they actually go to fighting, they really believe that they're on the good side. Like in Game of Thrones, you have characters that openly expose, I'm just in it for the money. I'm really a bad person at heart. I know it. But no one thinks like that. Like you and I, we're probably both really bad people, right, Dana?
Let's hope not.
But we don't think so, right?
No, for sure. Yeah.
No, but nobody in your class is, I'm a villain.
Yeah. Like,
but in Game of Thrones, that's what you get, is that, you know, people see themselves as dark characters and accept it, right? In the Middle Ages, they just wouldn't. You know, people went on crusade. They really believed what they're doing was right. That was the motivation. And that, you know, and they found ways of dehumanizing the other. Like that, my enemy is not even a human being. And that's how they said, we can do this. We can go in and we can attack them because they're against God. They're against everything that's right. So whatever we do is acceptable. So that's one of the kind of things I see, like in the darkness, is they play off the military as having no morality. And they would. We might disagree with that morality. Hopefully we do. But they play off as having just only for kind of short-term political gain. That's why they do it. And they understand that we're all playing some sort of game. Game of Thrones, right? And that's how they do it. But medieval people just didn't have that kind of view. Nor do we in modern day.
It's interesting. I have two thoughts on that. One is, one of the things that a lot of my students come to my medieval history courses with that I have to spend a lot of time challenging is they have this perception that medieval people weren't actually truly pious, that they were either tricked or duped by the Catholic Church, or that they were pretending. And so one of the things I have to try and convince them is, one, the Catholic Church isn't this evil institution, and two, that people did really believe in God, right? This was a real thing for them, and we have to respect that.
Definitely. I think religion is one thing that always gets played up in medieval shows as being a bad. Have you ever seen like a good cleric or monk?
It's very rare, right? I'd have to really think about that.
They always seem like they're ones that they can be either pulling the strings in the back and they're somehow sadistic, and they're always corrupt, right?
Yeah.
And I think the idea is the religion is corrupted.
Well, and I think Game of Thrones perpetuates that, right? But in an earlier podcast, I spoke with Sarah F. Decker about religion and violence on the show. And religion is presented really in this very one note way, right? It's corrupt, people use it for violence, and there's almost zero representation of people and their daily practice of religion, which makes sense. That's why the military part of it is devoid of that as well. You would think, and they would have, because obviously in the medieval period, these medieval warriors are concerned about their souls, but that's totally eliminated on the show. And I think it just plays with the rest of their discussion of religion too.
Yeah, in say medieval chronicles, it's very often that you see bishops or priests trying to get involved in conflicts to settle people down. We have two armies that are about to fight, and the bishops come in that let's do a peace, and they're trying to go back and forth and trying to negotiate, which is not very interesting for a TV show. But
the septons, who have these central, or I suppose of the religious leaders, have almost no connection to the military at all in this show, which again I think is perpetuating. Martin is really critical of religion, and I think that's just perpetuating his own particular perspectives about that. Our course is focused on thinking about Game of Thrones through the lens of medievalism, and I think some of our conversation has highlighted some of that already. So how do we think about the representation of warfare on a show like Game of Thrones as an example of medievalism? What can it tell us about people's expectations and what they want to see in a medieval, neo-medieval world, but also how people view the medieval period? And I think we've covered some of this already, but I'd love to hear more of your thoughts about it.
The one thing that Game of Thrones, the world of Westeros, really kind of perpetuates is the idea that nothing really changes.
Yes. Right?
And it's the way of the technology, right? Martin says, because there's magic, exists. But we have things where gunpowder, it exists that people know about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's almost like a forgotten knowledge. Things at Blackwater Bay, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
In the medieval world, that technology moves around really quickly around the entire Eurasian African world. It moves around and people are experimenting with it and using it in lots of different ways. So something like that kind of knowledge doesn't disappear. And it gets used and gets modified and changed. All sorts of technology happens in the Westeros. They're like, we've been like this for the last 5,000 years or something like that. Even though a farmer will be able to do better farming, the farms of the 15th century are far better than the farms of the 10th in productive quality. The people learned how to trade. They learned mathematics, science, and things like that. There's a curiosity. There's no element of curiosity or wanting to learn about other cultures. Not necessarily every medieval person wanted to explore the world and stuff like that, but there were. Knowledge spreads around.
It's a very insular society. That's one of the things that we've talked about before, too, is that Essos exists, and there's some people that we know go back and forth between Essos and Westeros. And there's a lot more discussion of it in the books, but in the show, we see Salladhor Saan once. He shows up, the pirate who's been, but we see very few other people from Westeros that are and Euron travels, but very few other people that are traveling between and thinking about other places and how those technologies and things that are happening in those other places might influence what's going on in Westeros. I think you're right. It's this very static society, and we see it over however many years it's supposed to represent, and nothing really changes.
We think our society moves so quickly, right?
Yeah.
You and I remember time when no internet existed, right?
Yes.
Don't think your students, for the most part, probably.
No, no.
So I think we think we're in a society that's always changing, and that earlier societies just were so slow that they didn't move. And also that their ideas just always stayed the same. The knight of 500 years earlier thinks the same as Jamie does, right?
Yeah.
but it's just not true.
And I think that's a reflection of medievalism and the idea that in the Middle Ages is the static period from whenever you decide that it starts until we see the development of the Renaissance as this, and then everything changes then. And I think that plays back into this idea of the Dark Ages, this time period when nothing is happening. And that's part of the reasons why I think Game of Thrones is problematic as seen as a show about the Middle Ages. Although some people still insist to me that it is a show about the Middle Ages. I'm like, not really.
As a show of Middle Ages, it's a show I think people in the Middle Ages would have liked.
Yes.
This would be a fun read. Yes.
Yes.
But they would have also seen it as not realistic. The depiction of the dragons are, it's not how it works.
I think they would have really liked the dragons. There's so many dragons in medieval literature. So our show has focused on this idea of medievalism, but I know some of my students are very interested in the details of the battles and weaponry as presented on the show. So how representative are these things of the medieval period? Obviously, there are no dragons, but what about the other things? What about catapults and crossbows and greatswords and pikes? And what also about the strategies that they use for fighting these battles?
In some ways, Game of Thrones gets some nice details right about using swords, the types of weapons, which is pretty common. A lot of movies and television shows, they have somebody that can say, oh, this is the type of sword that they might use in this particular period, and that's the type of armor. Because it's not any set in any particular time,
You can
make use of any type of armor. It's broadly historically correct. Sometimes the weapons are far more powerful than depicted in the films. Like the ones that are on the ships that shoot the first dragon. Mike Livingston did a piece where he said if that was a real weapon, that arrow shot would have actually went into space. So it was that powerful. There's always a desire to make the weapons larger, bigger, tougher, the spectacle of it. I'm not sure if it's in Game of Thrones or not, where is the flaming fireball being tossed against the city walls where they catapulted?
They do use flaming fireballs against the White Walkers.
Okay. They would have rarely, no one in the Middle Ages used flaming fireballs.
Yeah.
It's so common, it's because it's such a good visual, right?
Cinematically, it looks really good. Yeah. And what about the tactics? One of the articles that they read for this week from the Public Medievalist, and it's called Nothing About Warfare, Jon Snow. And it's critiquing the strategy behind the Long Night battle and the Battle of Winterfell. We talked a little bit about that, right? That people obviously are not going to come out from behind their walls. Yeah. But are there other aspects of these strategies that are obviously done for cinematic reasons and less reflective of the medieval?
Yeah, I think it's the absence of strategy you get in Game of Thrones. It's like
that's a good point.
They, in the Middle Ages, they had knowledge either that came from ancient times, and it was the medieval manuals and stuff like that, or would just be passed on. So they would know how to maneuver troops around a battlefield. They would know when to charge, how to flank an enemy. Flanking seems to be non-existent, right?
Yes, there's very little of that.
So the Thraki, for instance, okay, they're based on Mongols. They don't go in headlong charges. They fight with bows and arrows, and they would do maneuvers where they would move around their enemies and fight at a distance. So why are they going in the middle of night, going in a headlong straight attack with weapons when they know they can't win against? So they'd be just sacrificed for no reason. They don't do that. So there's a lot of weirdness in that. Hey, we're just going to fight because we're men. That's right.
Yes.
Everyone wants to fight to win, right? I think that night battle is like one where you look at the military historians, no, they wouldn't do that. They would never fight. So
that charge of the Dothraki, I've come back to in a few different of my podcasts. Earlier in the semester, we spoke to Shiloh Carroll, who has written a book on medievalism in Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire about race and racism in Game of Thrones. And she brought that up too. It doesn't make any sense to do that. These racialized characters, we can just sacrifice them, right? And cinematically, it doesn't make any sense either because you can't see them. their weapons on fire, but then you can't actually see what happens to them. They're just snuffed out. So I think it presents really troubling things beyond just this isn't representative of how this group even would have fought.
Yeah.
their reputation seems to be that people are afraid of them because of the way that they fight.
Yeah.
The dead don't care, right? Yeah, yeah. So they seem useless as this kind of thing. I think there's lots of things in that particular battle that I've read a lot about by many different medieval military historians who have critiqued particular aspects of it.
I think, yeah, especially with the racialized characters and the slave army,
yes.
They only fight one way. That's all they can. They don't have any ability to improvise.
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, it's another way, again, that they're representing these characters from Essos as having one note, this one ability, when clearly these are a highly trained mercenary army. I'm assuming in the medieval period that these would have been highly skilled fighters who would have been able to have a variety of different ways to approach a battle.
Oh yeah, exactly. They would have been able, hey, we're going to make use of this terrain. Most medieval armies are very conservative, especially if that's what you do for a living and this is how you get paid. Like mercenaries especially would, all right, how do we fight in the best way that preserves our lives? That's why everyone's behind walls. And so things like spying and observing the enemy, you don't have any of that. You make it the reference, oh, our scouts saw the army is, but that's very critical to medieval battles. Armies would usually know exactly where the other forces were and how they're coming, and let's set up for this, right? Let's use our advantages this way.
And again, I think there's the feeling that this doesn't make for good TV. Although I think for those that are interested in military history, it would be much more satisfying to see all those strategies behind what's going on. Well, another thing that Game of Thrones features that I've seen non-historians critique is the role of women as fighters and even leaders of armies. As a gender historian, I find the representation of women in these roles really fascinating on the show. So we have Brienne of Tarth and Yara Greyjoy and Lyanna Mormont, not to mention the assassin Arya Stark, but also Sansa Stark leading an army herself and many other women who are at the head of this. So do we have examples of women who participated in medieval warfare? What roles do they play?
First of all, we do have lots of examples of women participating in warfare. I think in mostly it's a leadership where you're a queen or a countess and yeah, you would be running the war. In part, these, because they're nobility, they command the forces, like they are their natural leaders. It may be that circumstances have put them into that. So one good example is the anarchy is of Stephen's reign, where
yes.
On one side, you have Matilda that's leading the Norman Angevin forces, and she's very much the leader of that group. When she captures Stephen, his wife, who's also named Matilda, I believe, she takes command. And the chroniclers that are supportive of Stephen's reign, generally, it's, oh, she had to do this, and she did a really good job. And,
yeah.
And then when she's able to get Stephen freed, they said she went back into her previous role. I think that she had a very major role in planning strategy throughout the reigns, and she would have been exposed to it. She would have had knowledge. She would have been able to offer advice. And yeah, she could command a castle or an army. She didn't participate in fighting herself. But we do have examples of that. I'm actually editing an article talking about women in early Islamic warfare.
Oh, wow. That sounds fascinating.
And the author's point is this is a tribal society. So that when you're in a tribe, everybody's involved. Often your brother or your uncle or your kids were involved in fighting. You would get involved in fighting too. And that sometimes you pick up a sword and shield and join them in the fight. I have a story of a lady named Qala bint Al Azwar, and her brother gets killed. So she takes up a sword and armor and goes on to the battlefield. Now, in the first instance, she actually covers herself.
Interesting.
She can't be seen, and she winds up riding down a couple of people and killing them. And then she reveals herself to the commander and says, yeah, I'm doing it to avenge my brother. And he puts her in charge of part of the army for her. So she actually leads commands. A lot of your students will know Joan of Arc. She literally leads armies. She's the first one in. She's wearing arms and armor, and the reason she gets executed is for wearing men's clothing, because she's wearing armor. So society can be accepting or not accepting of that role. Joan of Arc never, I don't think Joan of Arc ever kills anyone or like lays her sword on anyone. But she gets involved. Like she's climbing the walls, a ladder to attack the city. And she gets a stone, knocks her head, knocks her back.
So she's in the thick of, and do we have any examples of women that were disguised as men that later on were discovered? Or are these mostly that we have in literary examples?
Yeah, I think it's more like literary examples. Sorry, Mulan, right?
Yeah.
You know, where she pretends to be a man. If you were a nobility, you wouldn't have to pretend to be someone like that. Like you say, no, I will lead this force, and they will take it upon themselves to do it. And is sometimes it's very much spur of the moment, right? A lot of these, the attack, you know, I took a hatchet and I went to work. So not necessarily has to be, it's more of a fictional verse where they have to be dressed up.
I think that's one thing that I always like to emphasize is that when we think about these noble families and the defense of their territories, for example, or their roles in warfare, the women aren't excluded from that, right? This is a family enterprise where they all want to protect what belongs to their family. So of course the women are going to be able to step in when they're needed to, or they're going to be involved from the very beginning because they're part of the family that's protecting the assets that they own. My final question for you, out of all the battles on Game of Thrones, which was the most satisfying for you to watch as a historian of medieval warfare and why?
I went into the show, and I tried to keep my historian's hat off, right, as I watched. I really enjoyed the Battle of the Bastards. And not because of medieval, but I liked how they incorporated ancient warfare and medieval warfare together. So I thought it was very unique. I really liked how, we got the shields, this ancient Greek combat at the end. And then you also have the charges. I quite enjoyed it. I'm always trying to divorce myself from the idea, I'm watching a documentary. No, I'm not. If I was a medieval knight, I would have really enjoyed, look at how they put the Greek warfare into it. And not that we would ever use it, but it'd be very enjoyable as this the elements that they bring in.
I think cinematically, they do such a fabulous job in filming that. And I have to say, despite the problems I may have with different aspects of Game of Thrones, they do a really good job of filming the battle scenes.
Yeah, I watched Game of Thrones because I liked watching it. I liked it for its story, its narrative. And as a medieval historian, I can bring in other elements. And I don't necessarily do it to critique it, right? It's interesting how they play off. It often says a lot more about our present day culture, what they pick and choose as this is medieval.